America. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. Along with me is our special commentator and my dear friend, Jeffrey Hedquist. Hello, Jeffrey.
Greetings. Hi, how are you?
I'm glad you're with us.
All right, listen.
We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and we are calling from the heart of America, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today we have a fascinating live show today. We have three young scholars that won a economic scholars competition at Mises University 2009. And joining us today, provided we can get the technicalities taken care of here, will be Mr. Ed Perry from the Madison, Wisconsin area, who is going to be attending Indiana University in this coming fall, pursuing a PhD in economics, and Mr. G.P. Manish from the Boston, Massachusetts area, originally from India. He is a first-year PhD student in economics at Suffolk University in Boston. And we have Mr. Christopher Opperman. Christopher is 18 years old, just graduated from high school this past spring, from Atlanta, Georgia, entering into Harvard in the fall, considering a major in philosophy and economics. All three of these young gentlemen have distinguished themselves by placing first, second, and third in a field of 100 scholars in the Austrian Economics Young Scholars Competition at Mises University 2009. Now, I'm going to say welcome to you all, and I hope you're all with us. So we're going to start with the questions, and we're going to see who's with us and who isn't, and we'll go from there. I'm going to start with Ed Perry. Ed, are you there? Okay. So we
Hello?
Hello, is this Ed?
Yes, this is.
Good. Hi, Ed. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm very good.
Good. Now, I mentioned that you're up in Madison, Wisconsin area. 2 years ago, you just learned about Austrian economics. I'm going to start with you and ask you, why is it important for young people to be informed about sound economics, which we call reality economics, and you've been studying under the name of Austrian economics? Why is it so important these days?
I think the simplest reason is probably just because Austrian economics is just a really good tool for understanding the various consequences that will come about as a result of a lot of the different policies that are going on in Washington right now. So if you read a lot of the Austrian economic stuff, you will get just a basic good understanding of things. For instance, what's going on right now with the cash for clunkers thing.
Tell us about that. What is happening with that?
Well, as far as my understanding of it goes, is they're just they've allotted money so that they will take cars. I think it's 4,250 or something around that.
Between $3,500 and $4,500.
Okay, yeah, something like that. And so, in this case, one of the consequences that you could just already see if you just read some of the basic Austrian economics literature is that this is going to raise prices of used cars and used car parts.
And one of the most, since they're crushing these cars, it's going to take from the supply of cars that first-time buyers, people with less funds would otherwise be buying. They're still serviceable vehicles, correct?
Right, yeah, right. And this is especially relevant, I think, for young people.
Where does that $3,500 to $4,500 come from?
Yes.
Yeah,
where
right.
does that come from? It comes from us taxpayers. That's where it comes from.
That's right.
Exactly. And this goes back to one of the common things always talked about, the broken window fallacy, for example. That $3,500 to $4,500, which was taken through taxes to fund this payment to the cars, would have, of course, gone somewhere else. And
we're going to break in right now on you, Ed. We're going to have a brief break.
Sure.
Everybody, please stay with us. We'll be back after the break. This is Radio Free Market. Michael McKay, Jeffrey Hedquist. We're talking to Ed Perry and two other young scholars. We'll be back. Stay with us. And we're back. This is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist on Radio Free Market. And we are talking today with three young scholars, the first of which is Ed Perry. And Ed was just talking about the broken window fallacy as related to the cash for clunkers debacle that we are seeing promulgated on us right now. So, Ed, what were you just saying about the cash for clunkers program, and what is this like?
Well, yeah, I was just relating it to a really old example to show why it's mistaken to think that a cash for clunkers program would be beneficial for everyone, and relating it to the broken window fallacy. And the broken window fallacy was just really, briefly, it was that, say, if somebody broke the window of a salesman, that salesman would be forced to pay money in order to fix that window. And the reasoning was that this would result in a stimulus for the seller of windows and so forth, and it would spark a boon to the economy and somehow.
And that's not true, though.
Right, of course. The reason it's not true is because that money he spent to fix the window, had the window not been broken, would have been spent some other place. And, of course, that would have been much preferable because the window would have stayed intact, and yet there still would have been the spending still the same, which would have resulted in more wealth.
And this is why a good economist has to look at not only what is being done, but what is not being done, the seen and the unseen. And this is what Henry Hazlitt said in his Economics in One Lesson.
And yeah, it's a very good book just for understanding a lot of the outcomes of these various policies like cash for clunkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we constantly want to refer people to Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, and they can read this book and other books. Many books are available free online. And by the way, today, folks, today is a call-in show. Our 800 number is 800-313-9443. That's 800-313-9443. You're listening to the Radio Free Market. For our next question, we're going to turn to Chris Opperman. And Chris, are you with us?
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Chris. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good. So, you know, there's a common misconception about the current crisis that is being presented that somehow savings is bad and consumption is good. What's wrong with this thinking?
Well, I think one of the things that's wrong is that it kind of defies common sense. You know, you would think that in times of uncertainty or when you're trying to, you know, when you're trying to accomplish something, you save up for something. You know, when I was a little kid, if I wanted something, my parents would say, well, you know, go and save up for it. And if you want a new car, you save up for it. If you want a new radio, you save up for it. But the thinking that has come to Washington now is the idea that somehow the government can spend money that it doesn't have. And for some reason, that's somehow going to make us better off.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we like to lob around different terms for the listeners and in the effort to try to get them a little more educated. Most listeners just, you know, hear the news and read the newspapers, and they don't realize that what they're primarily being exposed to is something called Keynesian economics, which I like to refer to as shop until you drop economics. Because it's based on the concept of debt, it's based on the concept of consumption. In other words, we can pursue debt in our effort to try to create prosperity for ourselves. Whereas Austrian economics takes the approach of promoting the concept of saving and investing those savings into production. And that's a very different approach.
Absolutely.
There's one other aspect of this which is very interesting.
And this is Jeffrey talking
about.
And
the question is, with the value of the dollar plummeting, people are saying, well, I'd like to save, but if I do, it's just going to go away, so I should spend it now anyway. What's your take on that part of it?
Yeah, Chris, right. What do you think about that?
Well, that's another insight that's offered by Austrian economics, the concept that when a government has the authority to inflate a currency and to print up as much money as it wants, you know, it introduces those kinds of perverse incentives.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that Austrian economics teaches us is that what happens when the government prints more money is that as the government's printing more money, the value of the money in your pocket starts to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's one of the things that, for example, Congressman Ron Paul is very big about. You know, he's very big about monetary policy, and he's constantly speaking out in efforts to curb the power of the government to create money, to spend money. Mm-hmm. Because it's those kinds of policies like cash for clunkers, or even the fact that the government can print up as much money as it wants. And it's those policies and it's those actions that, you know, that often get us into this mess where we think that by consuming more we're better off, and that by buying things that we don't have money for, or by destroying things instead of effectively saving up for them and investing, we're somehow better off.
Really, really good point. So, hey, thank you, Christopher. Stay on the line. I'm going to turn now to G.P. Manish. G.P. is a first-year Ph.D. Student at Suffolk University in Boston. And G.P., are you with us?
Hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. So, G.P., you know, the language that is used by various politicians and the media are misleading constituents and the public into a blatantly unscientific approach. And a lot of misinformation is being presented out there. How do you see that situation?
I think it's basically, it works for the best interests of the politicians. I mean, it's because, like you were just talking about all this stuff with, you know, spend more instead of saving. When you're in trouble, I mean, as an individual, you would like to save more and consume less. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, all these points made by the media is just kind of like propagandizes something which so defies common sense. So I think it just works for the benefit of those in power. I mean,
now you mentioned that to me that you've had some experience dealing with mainstream economists while you were in grad school. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm in a program which is largely mainstream economics based. So yeah, I mean, it's so highly mathematical that it's very difficult to even think about the real world because it's so unrealistic.
So, in other words, let me cut in here. What you just said is about mainstream economics is not realistic.
Yeah, in the sense that if your starting points are all, you know, assumptions which are fictitious. So, if you're starting from a wrong assumption, all your deductions which you make from that wrong assumption are going to be wrong as well.
You know, there's a joke about mainstream economists that two of them fall in a hole, and one says to the other, how do we get out of here? And the first one says, well, first we assume a ladder.
Yeah, I mean.
And so they do make assumptions basically up, don't they?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the way, from whatever knowledge I have, I think it's largely to be able to use mathematics and economics. It's like an end in itself for the mainstream to be able to use mathematics and economics. So the reality of their assumptions kind of takes, you know, the back seat. It's like, okay, we'll assume stuff which we know isn't true just so that we can, you know, use mathematics in our...
Well, you know, I want to ask you one other thing about this. You know, what we are talking about today is Austrian economics, which I like to call reality economics, which really has a much more long-term view for economic analysis. And it's my observation that what is called mainstream economics really focuses on the short term and forces everyone to look at the short term. Would you agree with that?
I would say, yeah, it is. As far as you talk about Keynesian economics, I mean, the thought of Keynes and the Keynesians, yeah, what you're saying is correct, which would be, I mean, but there are many different schools in mainstream economics, but some of them are not so short-term as the Keynesian school. But as far as what you're talking about, the prevailing ideology, which, I mean, seems to be around us right now, what you're saying is absolutely true.
Why do you consider the Austrian economic approach superior?
Simply because, like you say, it's real. It starts from a real axiom in the sense that it starts from by saying that, you know, all human beings act. We have ends, and we use means to achieve those ends. So that is so real, I mean, in the sense that, so if you start with something real, everything which you deduce from that, everything which you reason out from that is also going to be real. So it's kind of like the complete opposite of mainstream economics.
And so would you have any advice for people who are just developing an interest in economics?
Oh, yeah, I would be. It would be to. I mean, I think economics is a great subject. I mean, why we should. I mean, I would encourage them to read up more, especially go to, like you said, go to Mises.org.
What kind of things would you suggest for people to read?
I would say, I think you were just discussing Henry Hazlitt's new book. I mean, sorry, Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great place to start. I would say there's also a book by Gene Callahan, Economics for Real People. It's like a, you know, it's like a fundamental, a stripped-down version of Austrian economics.
That's available on the web, isn't it?
Yeah, these are all, I mean, with Mises.org, everything is available on the net.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I have to say, though, that ultimately, I mean, you have to read Mises' Human Action.
Okay.
That, I mean, unless, and I mean, to understand the depth of the thoughts which drive most of the scholars associated with Austrian economics and the Mises Institute, one would have to read Mises' Human Action. But that's a very forbidding, you know, reading because it's...
Well, there's a new study guide available
by
Bob Murphy.
Yeah, exactly, Bob Murphy's, yeah, Robert Murphy's study guide, which, I mean, yeah, so that's great.
Okay. Well, this is very fascinating. This is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist, and we are on Radio Free Market. And today we're talking with some young scholars that just completed the Mises University 2009 in Auburn, Alabama. And we're going to come back in just a minute, and we're going to be talking more about how we can apply this to our daily lives and why this is important for everyone's future.
We are back with Radio Free Market. Michael McKay, my name is Jeffrey Hedquist, and we have three. Michael and I are kind of a bash. Number one, we're much older than this generation, and number two, they seem to be a lot smarter than us, which is very good.
Speak for yourself, Jeffrey. Thank you very much.
Christopher Opperman and G.P. Manish. Ed, what we're going to ask is, you're part of a different generation, and it's a generation that may, in a lot of ways, not know as much about economics as some of the older people, but they definitely need to have an interest in it, because what happens in the next few months and years really determines what happens with our money and our lives for generations to come. What could you say that's inspirational, maybe shocking, and maybe motivational to your peers about the information that you've got about economics? Ed?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be shocking or anything, but a piece of advice that I heard a couple of times just this past week at the Mises Institute for young people who are really interested in economics, and especially promoting the cause of freedom, is just to try and figure out what your niche is. And try and find out what you think you're good at, and not try and do everything, and then use what you think your relative talent is compared to other people, and try and use that to promote the cause of freedom. And if everybody does this, going into these different areas and trying to gain some expertise in promoting the cause of freedom, I think overall it would be really effective in the long run for raising awareness about the soundness
Excellent.
Of
let me jump in here, Jeffrey. This is Michael.
Yep.
Ed, I want to ask you, what advice would you give to your younger brother, your younger sister, who may be 20 years old, just getting started, and really doesn't understand, you know, money, economics, and so on? What are the things that you think they are really important for them to know?
Boy, the most important thing, which I think a lot of young people lack, is just to start to think for themselves. I think a lot of people are just sort of take what's fed to them. And I guess the best way I would say to do this is to suggest a couple of good books that you've read that you thought opened up your mind. I've always liked, for instance, Murray Rothbard, and I think he's exceptionally clear in the way he writes. So, like, for example, What Has Government Done to Our Money?
That's a really good book. That's available free online, isn't it?
Yeah, right. All his stuff is available free online. So if
and
you want to know
again, is What Has Government Done to Our Money?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, money has always seemed like this forbidding subject that's really difficult to learn. But if you read Murray, it becomes clear that when somebody who wants to explain it in the right way, he can do it, and he can do it so that anybody can understand it with a decent amount of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. That's great. And I wanted to ask Chris Opperman. Hey, Chris, what advice do you have for your parents and older folks that may be listening?
Sure. Well, I guess my advice applies to pretty much anyone in general. And it's pretty much that if you have an interest in economics, you know, we can still relish in the fact that, you know, every day we meet people on a very personal level. We have our friends, we have our colleagues at work, we have our fellow students at school. And so the most important thing is, like Ed said, kind of maybe pick a little niche or a little area that we'd like to specialize in or study a little bit more about, and, you know, just immerse ourselves into it. And then, since we have our personal connections and our friends, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to go and talk to people about this stuff. My introduction to Austrian economics came simply through a personal acquaintance. And, you know, that I got interested just knowing somebody that knew about Austrian economics. And, you know, and another thing that makes this important is the fact that often ideas flourish when you're arguing or when you're debating with somebody. A lot of times the best way to strengthen your beliefs is to put them to the test. And to see what other people think and what other people have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
so
really,
that
very good.
And so to encourage that dialogue is one of the best things you can do.
So, GP, what advice would you give to your elders, your parents that may, you know, not understand economics properly?
To read, I mean, exactly what Ed said. I think Ed said exactly the right thing, like to just open up your mind and not, you know, be to I would recommend them a book. Like, I mean, something like by Rothbard or even Hazlitt, to get them started, you know, to think on their own and to understand the world around them, because that's what economics helps you to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my biggest, I mean, piece of advice. But I'd also like to say that, I mean, to everybody, I mean, who's young or old, who is interested in economics, that, you know, they should never let anything hold them back, in the sense that, you know, if they don't have a degree, like an official degree in economics or something like that, you shouldn't let that hold you back. If you love the subject, just study it, and, you know, and like Chris said, just go around talking to everybody. I mean, you know, your personal acquaintances, your friends, your family. So never let, like, the fact that, oh, I'm not, like, officially trained in economics, don't let that hold you back.
Mm-hmm.
If you love the subject, study it. It's open to, I mean, any human being with intelligence can understand this. You know, we are all, I mean, that's what I would like to say, basically.
Well, you know, this is kind of an open question. I'm going to let any one of you jump in here. But, you know, in the last election, a lot of young people we saw supporting President Obama in the last election, and a lot of them are today supporting things like national health care and other things that, from an Austrian perspective, are really quite a disastrous option here. When we come back from the break, I'd like to kind of go on a round table and talk about how that, you know, how we can talk to these people and what we can do. This is Radio Free Market, Michael McKay, and we will be back in just a couple of minutes, so please stay with us. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, along with me, Jeffrey Hedquist, and we have our fascinating panel, Ed Perry, G.P. Manish, and Christopher Opperman, three young scholars who attended Mises University 2009, and all of them distinguished themselves as winning the Young Scholars Competition. We've been talking about this reality economics, and I like to point out that, you know, there is basically two definitions of economics. One is the study of the allocation of scarce resources. That's the one that everybody, you know, reads in the textbooks, which is really about the management of stuff. And we have discussed on this show a couple of times that economics is also the study of how people choose to cooperate with others in harmony or not. And the value that Austrian economics has is that this choice of people to cooperate with others in harmony offers them an integrated approach to actually living in a more peaceful and prosperous world. And so, you know, these various different topics that we talk about here, whether they be cash for clunkers or others, are all integrated. So economics, in a real sense, isn't just about money. It's not just about things. It's really about our lives, the quality of our lives, all of our lives, individually and collectively. And so let's talk in that kind of, with that kind of a background, about this concept of
Austrian economics. You know, last week we had Bob Murphy on the show. He's the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, and he pointed out that the key culprit of the Great Depression in the 1930s, as well as the crisis that we're experiencing today, is the Federal Reserve and our central banking system. So, Ed, I want to ask, start with you. Can you give us a brief explanation as to why this is so?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. So what happens is that the Federal Reserve, it has this power to, essentially we can think of it as just printing money. And what happens is that as a result of it printing money, the way it does it is the money is printed to our banking system. And in going to our banking system, since there's more money than there would otherwise be, this means there's more money to loan out, which causes the interest rate to be below what it would otherwise be. And when the interest rate is lower than it would otherwise be, and Austrians would say this interest rate, the money interest rate, would be below the natural rate, this will cause businessmen and entrepreneurs to take out loans at this interest rate and take on projects which would be profitable with this lower interest rate, but which would actually not be profitable had this interest rate not been lowered.
So let me kind of synopsize what you said here. You tell me if I'm saying it correctly. There's a price for money. If you want to rent money, there's a price for it, and that's called an interest rate. This is
right.
What, you know, business people are charged. And if they're thinking of a long-term project, they would like that interest rate to be pretty darn low.
Right.
And so if they see that interest rates are set low artificially by this Federal Reserve, which just basically announces it, you know, there's no market in there. There's no market forces, just, you know, a couple of guys sitting around the table saying, oh, we're going to set it at X. They think, oh, okay, well, this money's cheap. I think I'll go ahead and borrow some and invest that into long-term projects like building a, you know, factory or something of that nature like that. So what winds up happening when they get this cheap money and they go in this long-term direction?
Well, what happens is that what really needs to happen in order for that to be a viable project is that people need to save, and that's how the interest rate would fall. But in actuality, since the government has fictitiously created the illusion that their savings, is that over
by
time...
By the creation of just new money.
Right.
Okay.
This investor will find over time that he doesn't have enough to put through the project. He'll find that he won't be making enough money as a result of this project that he took on. And one really good simple example, I think, Mises had a good one. He had a builder with bricks.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said, for example, this would be akin to, say, the builder starting a project and being fed information about more bricks than what was really available to him. And at the end of the project of whatever he was building, whether it be a house or whatever it may be, he would suddenly find that he doesn't have enough bricks to complete the house as he thought he would. And suddenly this whole project would crumble, and he would have to revert to a much less wealthy project than he could have had if he would have known the actual amount of bricks that were available to him at the beginning.
So he created what happened for him is what Austrians call malinvestment. They make
right.
a mistake and they invest in something that really just can't. It was a mistake right from the beginning. We have a caller from Massachusetts, Mr. Leo. Are you there? Hello, Leo. We are listening for Leo in Massachusetts.
Now I think I'm on.
Oh, hello, Leo. This is Michael McKay.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for taking the call. I think that what we have here is a failure to communicate. We have a bunch of people who can't look beyond, if I have money, where can I spend it? And this is what has caused the problem. But I think the real problem on a global basis is that we're creating so much trash by planned obsolescence. And I think the real push should be to globalize creation of manufactured goods under certain standards with allowing for improvements, but somehow to not have this proliferation of junk. I mean, there's so much stuff that becomes so obsolete. It's just, you know, in the name of free market and freedom to make this and that, and it's all well and good. But how do we balance off standardization versus invention and creation of new products. That's a really tough nut to crack, I think.
Okay. Ed, you want to take a whack at that?
I'm not exactly clear. Are you saying you think there needs to be standards and less free market in order to decide what we should make and what we shouldn't? Or?
Well, what I'm basically saying is that within the manufacturing process of hard goods, okay, let's throw arts out the window. Within the manufacturing process of hard goods, we have so many different varieties. And it's, you know, in one way it's wonderful, but in the other way, I would kind of wish that a wheel from a Buick would fit on a Dodge and things like that. What I'm saying is interchangeability of basic elements should be a constant type of thing, and let people make their own flair of non-essential items. Now, I'm balancing, how do we balance that specific standardization off against having actual development? Should things that want to develop be put on the shelf until they prove themselves for X amount of years? Or, I mean, do you see where I'm going with this?
Kind of. I mean, sometimes I think when there seems to be like too many different things on, some people have a problem with too many different things that are superfluous. But I think this isn't really so much a problem with the free market. It's just, it's maybe more of a problem with what things that people want. Because all the free market really does is it creates what people want. And it's really the best mechanism for doing this.
You mean, are you referring to all the created wants also that aren't really necessary?
Well, necessary by whose definition, Leo? You know, you say they're not necessary. You know, I kind of like my own individual, unique, hard-to-find Buick wheel, you know? And I mean,
Michael,
you know, I mean, there's, you know, the upshot is that, pardon me, but aren't you suggesting that somebody should actually just make these decisions for us?
Not really. I think that we should have a long-term board effect on a worldwide basis. So
board?
That...
Board as in group of people?
Yeah, as in group of nationalities and people, actual on a grassroots level. None of these
but
officials
making.
I'm not talking about officials
for
making
other people.
I'm not talking about officials making decisions for us.
Oh.
I'm talking about grassroots making decisions on a national level, and then aggregating that so that we kind of clean up the mess of proliferation of variety to a discernible level. In other words, I want interchangeability of parts so that if I have a bicycle wheel from a Peugeot, it will fit on a Murray. And
well,
things like that. That's the type of thing I'm talking about, because what we have here is an overproliferation, and we have all this junk now that's left over that won't fit in with other products. And, I mean, I live on a mechanical scale, and I see the level of junk I have to throw up because... Well, this doesn't match that, and that doesn't match this, and la-di-da-di-da.
Well, I want to thank you very much for calling in, Leo. We got another caller coming in, but we're going to make this comment before you get off the line.
Okay.
We really want to recommend that you read this book.
I want to hear the answer to it also. Okay,
we're going to be talking about it. I think, candidly, I'm going to make an answer, and Ed, Chris, GP, please
sure.
Chime in. But my answer on this is that you... What I'm hearing from you, Leo, is that you really want some kind of centralized control that is not really free market. And that's really not what's going to solve the problem for you. Innovation.
Michael, if I could chime in here.
Yeah.
This is Chris here. If I could chime in. I think one of the things that Austrian Economics helps to contribute is the notion that the right level of X is something that's kind of arbitrary. So the only way to actually really decide that is in the market. It's kind of like what Ed was saying, that the only way to determine how much standardization people want is to actually let them decide. And let the, as Ludwig von Mises said, every day in the market we vote with our dollars.
Yeah, and that's a messy process.
Right.
And
then another quick thing is that standardization is something that's profitable. One of the examples that some of the guys at the Mises Institute use is there's no triangular ATM card, because you know if there were a triangular ATM machine, it wouldn't be compatible with all the other ones. So
right.
It's for the same reason that software now is compatible, that Macs are increasingly using a lot of the same programs as Windows because it's more profitable.
Right, exactly. That's a very good point. Okay, we have another caller, John from Tennessee. Are you there, John?
Hello.
Hello, John.
Yes, you know, Leo actually prompted my call. I'm driving down the road. I'm listening to your program and thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying it, especially the one guest that said, basically, if you love economics, you don't have to have a degree. Well, you know, I look at it a couple different ways. First of all, who taught the teacher? Who got the first degree?
Mm-hmm.
Did he go to a school of degrees or did he create the school? Here's what I'm saying to Leo. Leo, I've got a 1940 Ford 8N tractor. Now, the guy that had it before me let it run 65 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure if he can run it 65 years, Leo, if I take care of it and I do what's right, I can run it 65 more years. So it's a matter of what do we want to do? Do we want to have a quick fix? Do we want to go out and purchase? Or do we want to repair and understand how things work?
But, you know, another thing, John, I noticed that Leo actually points out a need. A need is, you know, for things to maybe fit with one another. Maybe he can invent some kind of a device that allows different elements to interchange more easily.
Those are called adapter kits, and they exist. So,
yeah.
You know, he mentioned a Murray bicycle and a Peugeot bicycle. Well, the old Chryslers, the tires and rims fit Fords. Now, not a lot of people know that because they say, well, I got a Chrysler. Well, I've got a Ford. And I'm saying that to say this. We can throw money away because we understand, you know, that it's not really worth anything anyway, or we can use it wisely, not necessarily by investing it wisely, but by spending it wisely, getting our, you know, the old deal about getting your money's worth. Did you get your money's worth? I mean, you're exchanging your life for a wage. You need, if you care for your life, spend your wages a little more earnestly with a lot more thought. And you know, it'll go around. It'll come around. When I heard Leo talking about standardization and basically mandating it, that is not free market. That is not, you know, that's not free enterprise. It's not a way to build an economy. What we're seeing here is we're getting more fish in the fishbowl, you know, and for this propped up Ponzi scheme of a game to continue, they've got to continue to give people a reason to buy something.
Mm-hmm.
If you made a automobile now that would last 20 years properly maintained, and they do, I'm driving a pickup truck with 250,000 miles on it. I don't want a new one. It's paid for.
Mm-hmm.
It was paid for the day that I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you make something that's going to last, there's a lot of people all over the world that are going to be out of work.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a projected life. When they manufacture something, they know technology is going to improve. And in 5 years, 7 years, 2 years, 1 year, there's going to be a technology that people are going to want. I drove a Murray lawnmower. I've got a couple acres. I bought a Murray lawnmower. I used it 10 years. When I went to Murray for parts, they said, what are you doing driving this? We designed them. This is coming from Murray. We only designed them to last 5 years. How did you get 10 years out of that lawnmower? It's called preventative maintenance.
That's great.
I'm a cheapskate. I mean, you know, you see it. Seriously. You get a car. You know, it's paid for. And you have that debt monkey off your back if you had gone into debt to purchase it. But you find your neighbor pulls up in a brand new car. And you can't be something less than your neighbor. What will the neighbor?
Well, actually, what you're doing, John, is by maintaining your things, you're actually creating a new form of savings for yourself because you're able to put other monies to work at other things for yourself.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's right. That's great.
No kidding.
Hey, John, thanks for calling. Please call in again. We got another caller, Kathleen in Iowa. Are you there, Kathleen?
Hello.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you today?
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to go back to the discussion that you were having and explaining why fictitious interest rates are bad.
Okay.
And you were using the example of a person starting a project because money was available at a lower interest rate that was set by, I suppose, the Federal Reserve or whoever. But we didn't take it to its conclusion.
Okay.
And that's what I'd like to do, because I think part of the problem is that Americans don't understand why fictitious interest rate setting is bad. And so if you've got this cheaper money and so you start that bigger project, why isn't it going to be profitable?
You know what, Kathleen? Thank you for asking that question. We want to get into it. We're going to have to take a break now. But when we get back, we have a short segment. We're going to try to cram that answer and a little bit more into the last, you know, 4.5 or so minutes that we have. So this is Radio Free Market. Please stay on the line, Kathleen.
Michael
McKay will be back in just a couple of minutes. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
And we are back with Radio Free Market. I'm Jeffrey Hedquist, and the leader of the pack, of course, is Michael McKay, and we are here with three astute students from the Mises Institute. And we're following up with a comment that Kathleen made. She wanted us to carry that scenario of artificially created interest rates to its conclusion. And I'd like to start with Ed.
You put that on hold.
Exactly. We put him on hold.
So, GP.
Yeah, okay.
We'll start with GP, yes.
Okay, so I think, the question's a very good one, because the fact is that you have to understand what the interest rate signifies. If it wasn't fictitious, if it were real, it would signify the amount of resources which are saved by people and ready to, you know, to be invested. So if you have a fictitious interest rate, what that means is that nobody has saved that money to invest. So it's just money which is printed out of thin air. So it's basically building, like, it's like a Ponzi game. It's a house of cards. So sooner or later, either it's going to fall or the Federal Reserve has to keep printing the money in order to keep this Ponzi game going. So either you're going to have hyperinflation, what Mises called the crack-up boom, or you're going to have what you're having today, which is basically a crisis.
Right. Does that clarify that for you, Kathleen?
Well, I guess what I don't understand is if I get to borrow that money at a cheap rate,
mm-hmm.
and I do invest in the project, and so why the resources are obviously I'm confused about why it won't be profitable.
Well, it may be profitable for you because you may get in and you may get out before everybody else. The real question is, why is it that we have a crisis that happens where so many people have made the same mistake at the same time?
Right.
You know, it's not really probable that people are going to make so many people are going to make the same mistake at the same time. Unless some central player has goofed everybody up. And that central player is the Federal Reserve and their artificially setting of the interest rates.
But I think if we could make the American people understand why that artificial interest rate is detrimental, then I think that, you know, we could affect some changes in policy and perhaps, you know, deal with the elimination of the Federal Reserve, or at least the kind of control they have over our money.
I'm with you 1,000%, and please tell your friends to listen to our show.
But unfortunately, I can't explain it.
That's okay. Go to Mises.org, Mises.org, and, you know, start combing the things. I would start with the, Economics in One Lesson. That's an excellent one.
Okay.
That book that by Rothbard that was mentioned earlier.
What Has Government Done to Our Money?
Exactly.
What has government done to money?
What Has Government Done to Our Money?
Okay.
An excellent book by Murray Rothbard. You can read it free online. And in the popular stores at Amazon.com and so on, you can read Meltdown by Thomas Woods. And a quick plug, next week we're going to have a taped interview with Thomas Woods, New York Times bestselling author, on his bestselling book, Meltdown. And we're going to be discussing this topic as well as others next Saturday at 1:00 Central Time. So,
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And so now we want to turn to Chris for a minute. Let's talk about the role of ethics in economics in the couple of brief minutes we have left. Why is ethics so important? Oh, geez, we're running out of time. We're out of time today. Chris, you got a 10-second answer?
Sure thing. I guess the bottom line is, a great quote that a liberal is someone who feels a great debt to his fellow man, which he proposes to pay off with your money.
All right, this is Radio Free Market. Michael McKay, Jeffrey Hedquist, until next week.
Thank you very much for your attention, folks, and please come and visit us at radiofreemarket.com. And thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Great.
Thank you.